You travel somewhere new, a place to slow down, to breathe, and to gently let go of the day. There is nothing you need to do, nowhere you need to be. Just listen and allow yourself to drift. Tonight, you are getting on a train, not just any train, a sleeper train, a train that will carry you through the night. While you sleep, north through England, across the border into Scotland, arriving in Edinburgh as the city is only just beginning its morning. This is one of the oldest pleasures available to the traveller, to go to sleep in one place and wake up in another, to let the train do the work while the night does its own work, and to arrive somewhere new with the particular freshness of someone who has slept through the distance. The train is called the Caledonian Sleeper, and it is waiting for you at London Euston. The station is quieter in the evening than it is during the day. The daytime crowds have thinned. The concourse, which by mid-afternoon is a constant flow of people and announcements and the restless energy of a place that processes a great many departures, has settled now into something calmer, the footfall lighter, the echoes more distinct in the high space above. You walk the length of platform one. The sleeper train is already there, long and dark blue, its carriages stretching away into the dim platform light, with the quiet authority of something that knows exactly where it is going and is in no particular hurry to begin. But before the train, the lounge. The guest lounge is just off the platform, a room apart from the evening bustle, and inside it, the atmosphere changes immediately. Softer lighting, the smell of coffee, the low sound of other people doing the same thing you are doing, which is settling in, getting comfortable, beginning in a small way to leave London behind. You find a chair, you order something warm. The lounge is a kind of threshold, the space between the city you are leaving and the journey not yet begun, and there is a particular pleasure in occupying it, in being neither here nor there, in the permission of an in-between hour, when nothing is required of you, except to sit and be warm and drink your drink, and let the evening arrange itself. People around you have the look of people on the same journey, unhurried, a little anticipatory, some with books, some looking at their phones, in the way people do when they are not really looking at their phones, just holding them as an excuse to be still. Outside, through the smoked glass, platform one runs away into the distance, and the train waits. You do not rush. There is time. There is always time in a lounge before a train on the evening of a good journey. Boarding is quiet. You follow the platform in the cool night air. The carriages numbered in sequence, the attendant at the door with a particular calm of someone who has made this journey many times and still finds it entirely worth making. Your berth is small. This is not a surprise. A berth on a sleeper train is not a room. It is something closer to a nest. A narrow, perfectly arranged nest with a bed along one wall, a window above it, a small fold-down shelf, and a duvet that is warmer than you expect, and immediately suggests the correct thing to do with it. But that flank it. It was designed by an Edinburgh-based designer named Ian Smith, and what he created is an interior that understands its own purpose, which is to be the heart of the train, the place where the journey is allowed to become an experience, rather than simply a passage from one place to another. There are comfortable booths along one side, upholstered in deep colours, and swivel seats against the windows on the other, positioned so that you can turn toward the glass and watch the world go by. As the train gathers speed through the outer London suburbs, and the lights thin and the dark begins, you take a booth. The menu is Scottish, properly, confidently Scottish. Haggis with neeps and tatties, served with a whiskey sauce. Venison stew with horseradish mashed potato. A Scottish cheese plate with oatcakes and chutney. The oatcakes made by Narns. The cheese a smoked cheddar from Lammermuir, whose name carries the smell of the hills in it. You order something warm and substantial. You order a dram of something Scottish alongside it. The whiskey arrives in a small glass, and you hold it for a moment before you drink it. The colour of it amber and complex in the club car light. And you take a slow sip and feel it move in a warm line from your throat to somewhere central, somewhere that responds to whiskey the way a fire responds to a small addition of wood, a deepening and a settling. Outside the windows, the city is thinning. The lit up junctions and sidings of the outer suburbs give way to longer gaps of darkness. The occasional lit window of a house near the tracks slides past and is gone. The train is accelerating into the kind of dark that only exists outside cities. The dark where you can begin to see stars above the occasional small town. As the train passes through and leaves it behind, you eat slowly, you drink slowly. The train rocks very gently on its tracks, a low and constant motion that the body registers as comfort rather than disturbance. The same rocking that has been soothing travellers on sleeping trains since the first berths were fitted to the first night services, and someone discovered that the rhythm of the rails does something to the nervous system. That is very close to what a lullaby does. Eventually, you make your way back along the swaying corridor to your berth. The bed has been turned down. You take off your shoes. You pull back the duvet. The window beside the bed shows you the dark of Middle England passing. The occasional orange light of a motorway junction far away. The lamplit platform of a station the train does not stop at, sliding past and gone before you have quite registered it. You lie down. The pillow is cool. The duvet is exactly the right weight. The train sways beneath you with that slow, constant rhythm. And outside the window, the darkness continues, and the rails make the low sound beneath the carriage, and there is nothing you need to do, and nowhere you need to be, and Scotland is somewhere ahead in the dark, and you are going toward it without effort while you sleep. You sleep, not the sudden sleep of exhaustion, but the gradual, willing sleep of someone who has eaten well and is warm and is being carried through the dark by something that knows the way. You You sleep through the Midlands. You sleep through the North. You sleep through the crossing into Scotland. Though somewhere in the night, in the soft half-awareness that sleep sometimes keeps, you feel the train slow briefly, and the air seems to change, or perhaps you imagine it, a slight shift in temperature or quality, the suggestion of something older and wider in the darkness outside, and then you sleep deeper. The attendant's knock is gentle, just a soft knock on the door of the berth, and a quiet voice saying the name of the station, the name of the city, and you come up through, sleep slowly, the way you surface through water, the berth reassembling itself around you, the window already showing a new light, the blue-grey light of early morning in Scotland, not dark and not yet fully light, the sky the colour of pewter over low hills, Edinburgh, Waverley. 20 minutes. You dress slowly in the narrow berth, which requires a kind of companionable negotiation with the space, and you fold the duvet back, and you look out the window at the first light of Edinburgh arriving. From the east, pale and clean, catching the top of something stone and high. In the distance, before the train curves into the station, the platform at Waverley is long and quiet. Just you and a handful of other sleeper passengers, all of you carrying the particular self-possession of people who have come from somewhere through the night and arrived somewhere new in the morning, which is a different thing from arriving after a day journey, a different arrangement of the self. You came through the dark. You are here now. It is morning. You walk up the platform and find the steps, the Waverley steps, a wide staircase that leads up from the station into the city above, because Edinburgh Waverley sits in a valley, in the long gap between the old town to the south and the new town to the north, tucked below the street level of both, so that to leave the station you have to climb. You climb. And at the top of the steps, Edinburgh arrives. It arrives in a way that no amount of preparation quite prepares you for, because the city at 8 in the morning in October is almost completely quiet, and that quiet gives the architecture the space to be fully itself without the overlay of traffic and crowds that it must usually compete with. Prince's Street is in front of you, and to the left, wide and straight, the buildings of the new town on the north side, the long drop of Prince's Street, gardens on the south, and above the gardens, rising from its volcanic plug of black basalt, Edinburgh Castle. The castle at this hour is extraordinary. It sits on its rock against the pale morning sky, in a way that makes the word ancient feel inadequate. The rock is 350 million years old. The castle has been here in some form since the 7th century. It does not notice your presence. It does not need to. It simply sits above the city with the settled authority of something that has been watching this particular view for longer than most things have existed. To your right, a clock tower, the Balmoral Hotel, 190 feet of Scottish baronial stone. At the east end of Prince's Street, its great clock face visible from where you are standing, the hands showing, as they have shown since 1902, a time that is 3 minutes fast. Hospital's clock has been set 3 minutes ahead. Since it was first installed, a gift to the travellers below, extra minutes against the anxiety of a missed train. And it has been 3 minutes fast every morning since, through more than a century of Edinburgh mornings, all different and all the same. You look at it. You are in no danger of missing a train. Your train has already delivered you. But the 3 minutes feel like a kind of welcome anyway. A little extra time, just in case. And then, to the south of the gardens, past the castle, the Scott Monument. 61 metres of Victorian Gothic stone, decorated with 64 carved figures, each one a character from the novels of Sir Walter Scott, who gave his name to this station, whose Waverley novels lent to the station its name, which lent the trains their name, which brought you here this morning. The monument is dark and intricate against the pale sky, a narrow spire rising from a cluster of arches and turrets, and even at this hour, from down on the street, it asks you to look up. You look up. The sky above it is beginning to lighten towards something approaching blue. The hotel is close. You walk through the quiet streets, your bag over your shoulder, your footsteps on the cobbles making a clean, unhurried sound in the Sunday morning stillness. The old town begins just to the south, the buildings rising steeply up the ridge from the castle rock, the closes and winds cutting down between them. Narrow and shadowed, the stone of everything dark and old, the colour of smoke and rain and centuries, and yet not oppressive. The stone here has warmth in it, particularly in early light, when the sun catches the upper stories and turns them a deep, rich gold. You drop your bags. You do not linger, because Calton Hill is waiting and the morning is too good to waste on a hotel lobby. Calton Hill is east of the station, a short walk along Prince's Street and then up. Through the quiet new town streets, the hill rising above the city to the east in a way that is less dramatic than the castle rock, but no less commanding. You find the path and begin to climb. The hill is not tall, 102 metres, but in the morning light, with the city still and the air clear and October doing its best work, the climb feels like a gradual revelation. Each few meters of ascent revealing a little more of the city below. At the top, the monuments are waiting. The Nelson Monument first, a tower built in 1816 to commemorate Admiral Lord Nelson and his victory and death at Trafalgar. It is shaped like an upturned telescope, which is either a tribute to the Admiral's instrument of choice, or a piece of architectural humour, depending on how you look at it. At its top, a time ball is lowered each day, at exactly 1 o'clock, in synchrony with the 1 o'clock gun, fired from the castle across the city, a daily signal that was once essential for the ships in the Firth of Forth to set their chronometers. Beyond the Nelson Monument, the National Monument stands against the morning sky. 12 vast columns of Edinburgh stone, modelled on the Parthenon in Athens, construction began in 1822. As a memorial to those who fell in the Napoleonic Wars increase the funds, and so the 12 columns stand unfinished, a fragment of a building that was never completed, and in their incompleteness, they are, if anything, more striking than they would have been whole. A ruin that was never quite built, a monument to aspiration, and the gap between it and achievement. You stand beside the columns. They are enormous, up close, taller than they appear from the street below. The stone is cold and very smooth under your fingertips and beyond the columns, the view. Edinburgh opens below you in every direction. To the west, the castle on its rock, the spire of the Scott Monument visible below it, the long spine of the Royal Mile running from the castle's foot, eastward to the palace of Holyrood House, the old town pressing close on either side, the roof lines irregular and ancient, the chimneys catching the early sun. To the north, the new town's Georgian grid descends in orderly ranks of stone terraces toward the water of Leith, and beyond it, Leith itself, the port and the docks, and the Firth of Forth, stretching away to the north and east, wide and grey silver in the morning light, the far shore of Fife, a low, dark line at the horizon, and to the southeast, rising above everything else on this side of the city, a great dark hill, Arthur's Seat. It fills that part of the sky the way a hill should, with a settled authority, its summit blunt and rocky above the long sweep of its flanks, the Salisbury crags hanging off its western shoulder, like a cloak of dark basalt, the park below it pale and open. You look at it for a long time. You make a note, in that wordless way you sometimes do, to come back here at sunset. The view from Calton Hill at the end of an October day would be something worth seeing. But first, the hill. The walk to Arthur's Seat begins at Holyrood Palace, at the far eastern end of the Royal Mile, and you reach it through the quiet morning streets, past the front of the palace which faces the road. With the low, composed dignity of a building that has been receiving important guests since the 16th century, and is entirely unsurprised by your arrival, the palace of Holyrood House, the official Scottish residence of the monarch, a long, relatively low building of pale stone, its two round towers framing the entrance gate, the Lion of Scotland on the wall above. It is an early morning building, a building that benefits from quiet, from the absence of tourist coaches and guided groups, from being seen as it is now, just a building and a gate and a garden, and the hill rising behind it. You walk past, and then the road enters the park, and the city falls back, and the hill is in front of you. The first thing you notice up close is the scale of it. From the street, from Calton Hill, Arthur's Seat looks imposing, but manageable. Up close, beginning the ascent, you understand that it is going to require something from you. More than you expected, perhaps. The path from the foot of the hill rises steadily. Along the base of the Salisbury crags, those great dark vertical walls of basalt that hang off the western flank of the hill, 60 meters of sheer volcanic cliff. That was was once the solidified rim of a magma chamber that was underground once, that the ice of 10,000 years ago exposed by simply removing everything around it. The stone is dark and rough and old, 340 million years old, give or take. You put your hand on it, cold, grained, real. The path continues upward along the base of the crags, and the views to the left are already opening. The city beginning to reveal itself from this angle. The castle visible through a gap in the crags, Calton Hill behind you and below. The Firth of Forth glimpsed between the rooftops, silver and flat in the October light. You keep climbing. The path finds a ridge above the crags and then turns east away from the city, and for a stretch you are walking through the higher park, the grass short and pale and slightly frost-touched at the edges, the kind of October grass that holds the cold of the night longer than the sun can reach it. In the sheltered hollows, there is a ruin up here, St. Anthony's Chapel, or the remains of it. A few courses of old stone, roofless, windowless, standing on a rocky knoll above the path, the walls just high enough to give a sense of enclosure, without containing anything except wind and light and sky. The chapel dates to the 15th century, possibly earlier, and no one is entirely certain now why it was built here, this high, this exposed, above a city that had perfectly good churches below. Perhaps because the height was the point. You stand beside the walls for a moment and look out from the chapel's former windows at the view that the people who built this would have seen every morning. The Firth of Forth, far to the north, the low coast of Fife beyond it, the farms and villages of the Lothian Plain, a very good view for a chapel. And then the ground dips slightly, and you come over a rise, and then the loch appears. Dunsapi Loch, a small, still body of water sitting in a hollow. Between Dunsapi Hill and the final approach to the summit, about 110 metres above sea level, its surface perfectly calm in the sheltered bowl of the valley. It was created in 1844 as part of improvements to Holyrood Park, but the basin it fills is a volcanic crater. Older than the idea of a park, older than the idea of a city below it, and before the lock was shaped and dammed into being here. It was simply a dip in the volcanic landscape, a place where water collected naturally. Bonnie Prince Charlie camped here once, on the night before he marched his army south, to fight the English at the Battle of Preston Pans in September 1745. The army spread across the hillside, and this hollow fires in the dark, the night before the battle, the loch beside them quiet and still. You try to imagine it. You do not entirely succeed. The imagination falters at that scale of history. But the loch is beautiful in the modest, certain way of small bodies of water in high, quiet places. Its surface holds the morning sky. A few coots move near the far bank with their deliberate, slightly indignant manner. The reeds at the edge are pale and dry at this time of year. The seed heads gone to down, the stalks bleached by October. You stand beside it for a moment. The wind, which has been building as you climbed, moves across the surface in a long, slow shiver. The coots continue, unimpressed. The final climb to the summit is the hardest part. The path becomes rockier as it rises, the volcanic basalt breaking through the grass. In irregular outcroppings, the surface uneven and honest, requiring attention, requiring you to look at where your feet are going, rather than at the view, though the view is becoming something. That is increasingly difficult to ignore. You climb, your breath comes a little harder. The wind is stronger now, with every 10 meters of ascent. The wind adds another layer to itself, not gusting, but building. A steady, pressing, cold, very alive wind. That comes off the further forth to the north, and has nothing to slow it down. Between the water and this summit, you lean into it slightly, you keep climbing. And then the summit, 250 meters above sea level, 822 feet, if you prefer the older measure, the highest point in the city of Edinburgh. The wind hits you fully here, a strong, cold, ocean-flavored wind that presses against your jacket and gets inside your collar and pulls at your hair and makes you feel, in the very best possible way, completely, entirely exposed to the world. Not dangerously, not unpleasantly, just fully, as if up here at the top of an extinct volcano that stopped erupting 340 million years ago, the usual distance between yourself and the elements, has simply been removed, and what is left is you and the wind and the view, and the October sky above it all, and the view. The view from the summit of Arthur's Seat is a 360-degree account of everything that this part of Scotland has to offer. To the north, Edinburgh is laid out below you. With the completeness of a map, every district visible. The old town on its ridge, running from the castle to the palace. The new town's Georgian grid to the north of it. Leith beyond that, and then the further forth. Wide and silver and very large in the morning light. The bridges visible in the distance if you know where to look. And beyond the Firth, the low dark hills of Fife. On the far shore, 30 kilometres away and perfectly clear. On a day as good as this one, you can see Calton Hill from here. You can see its monuments clearly. The Nelson Tower and the unfinished columns, reduced to toy scale from this height, and beyond them the buildings of the east end of the city, running down to the coast, to the west, the castle, which is strange to see the castle from above, from a vantage point that makes it look smaller and more ordinary than it is from the street, and yet also from here you can see clearly. The volcanic rock on which it sits, the sheer drop of its north and south faces, the way the rock was shaped by the ice, exactly to accommodate a fortress on its crown. To the southwest, the Pentland Hills, a long dark ridge slightly lower than the sky behind it, running southwest to northeast beyond the city's edge. The highest points above 500 meters, and in October, with a light coming from the south, the hills throw their western faces into shadow, and their eastern faces into a warm amber light. That makes them look closer and clearer than they are. To the east, the Lothian Plain opens up, the farmland of East Lothian spreading flat and wide toward the coast, and on clear days you can see Berwick Law, a lone conical hill near North Berwick, poking up from the plain like a smaller cousin of the volcano you are standing on. The city is almost entirely quiet below you. You have got here early enough. There are only a handful of other people on the summit, and they are doing the same thing you are doing, which is standing in the wind and looking and saying very little, because a very little needs to be said. The view says everything. You stand there for a long time. The wind presses. The city lies below. The Firth shines. The Pentlands hold their shadow on one side and their light on the other. October has done something generous today, given you the sun and the visibility and the crisp cold air. That makes distant things sharp and close. You are grateful for it. In the wordless way, you are grateful for things that simply happen to be good. The descent takes the way you came, past the log, where the coots are still there, still indignant about something, the surface of the water holding the sky above it in a trembling reflection, past the chapel ruin, the old walls casting short shadows in the late morning sun, along the path above the crags, the basalt enormous and cold and patient beside you, past the palace again, which is the same palace it was an hour ago, and will be the same palace an hour from now, and then the park gives way to the city, and the city receives you back with its usual quiet October business. Brunch is earned now. You find somewhere warm, not far, a cafe on a quiet street that has the look of a place that knows what it is doing with eggs and coffee, and does not feel the need to announce it loudly. You sit by the window. Outside, the street is still quiet. The city is still doing its gentle Sunday morning things. A couple walks past with a dog. A man on a bicycle, very upright, very certain of his route. Inside, the cafe is warm, the kind of warmth that reaches you slowly. After the cold of the summit, reaching your hands first, then your face, then something deeper. The warmth that comes from being in from the outside, after a long time outside, on a cold and good day, you order coffee, you order something with eggs, you sit back, you think about the view from the summit, and you think about the wind. And you think about the log and the coots, and the old chapel with its 15th century walls open to the sky, and you think about sunset. You promised yourself Calton Hill at sunset. That is still to come. But for now, the coffee arrives, and the food, and the October morning is outside the window, still going, the city getting on with itself, and you are warm and fed and pleasantly tired in the very best way. Later, much later, you are somewhere warm and still. The day has been very long and very good. The kind of day that settles into you, not as a list of things but as a feeling. The cold of the summit air, the wind that pressed against your jacket, the view of the city from 250 meters spread below you like a model of itself, the loch with the morning in it, the stone of the chapel walls very old, very cold, the Balmoral clock 3 minutes fast, keeping its generous fiction, a charging station. In the dark behind your eyes, the train is moving through the night. The rhythm of the rails, the rocking of the berth, the duvet warm and heavy. The dark outside the window, where England was passing unseen, and Scotland was approaching unseen, and you were asleep, and being carried, that rocking, steady and slow, the rails making their low sound, the world moving past outside. You breathe in, the train rocks, you breathe out, the summit wind. You breathe in, the Firth of Forth, silver and wide in the morning. You breathe out, the coots on the lock, deliberate and unhurried, moving through their morning. With the certainty of creatures who have always known exactly where they are. The old chapel walls, the basalt cold under your hand. 340 million years. The clock 3 minutes fast. A little extra time. Just in case. And now, as everything grows quieter, and the train rocks you gently through the dark, and the summit wind fades to something distant, and the city below the hill settles into its October evening, and your thoughts begin to soften at their edges. You can stay here, on the hillside, in the warm cafe, on the train, or drift somewhere deeper still, knowing the Firth of Forth is out there in the dark, and the castle is on its rock, and the coots are on the loch, and the summit is empty and windy above the sleeping city. And there is nothing left to do, and nowhere else you need.